Welcome to Rocket Talk, the Tor.com podcast. My name is Justin Landon, and I'm your host back again. I know you. Every time somebody logs into this podcast, you're probably wondering if it's going to be somebody else, but I have a wonderful guest tonight. I have Brian Stavely. He's taught literature, religion, history, and philosophy. He holds an MFA in creative writing from Boston University. His debut novel, The Emperor's Blades, was acclaimed in 2014, and his second novel, Providence of Fire, released this week. He lives in Vermont with his wife and son. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
Do you recognize the fact that I cribbed that entire bio from the back of the ARC that I have sitting in front of me?
It sounded eerily familiar. Eerily familiar.
Yeah, did you write those little bios, or is it like your editor that writes that?
Back in the day when I was still querying agents, of course, I worked on, you know, my query letter and bio. And then, you know, I think when my agent was trying to sell the book, you know, she kind of cribbed from that. And then when Marco, my editor, was trying to market the book, he kind of cribbed from it. So it's mutated over time, but I can kind of recognize the original germs in there.
Yeah, I find bio writing to be this weird skill that some writers are completely incapable of doing. Like, they just can't talk about themselves.
Yeah, you sound like an asshole if you say anything good. And you also kind of sound like an asshole if you say anything bad. There's really no way to win.
Yeah, I always go with like weird humor. Wes Chu asked me to write a bio for him for Phoenix Comic Con, and so I wrote this bio about him, how he and Michael Jordan were best friends, and like that was the bio. It worked great. You know, it's like it was tongue in cheek and not serious, but it totally conveyed the personality without using facts.
You could have a sideline doing this. I mean, there's a lot of authors who would hire you. Me at the front of the line.
Yeah, you know, actually, Wes suggested that I get into the bio writing business. The margins seem poor, but you know, you never know. Never know. It could be a whole gig. You know, they have copy editors like that they hire out freelance. Who knows? Maybe publishers need bio writers.
Yeah, you just got to go for volume. I mean, you could crank out 400, 500 a day.
Easily. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I get a little wordy, which is kind of the problem. You know, like I'm more of an 800 word bio kind of guy than I like to tell stories. You know?
I was for a long time, and you have to write comments about your students at the end of the semester, and you just have to be ruthless. You know, Justin shows up to class on time. He's a wonderful presence. He likes to talk. He doesn't read some of the books. He reads some of the others. I look forward to next semester with Justin.
Excellent student. Justin talks too much. So it has been just exactly a year since your first book, Emperor's Blades, came out.
Yep.
And I have to admit that when that book came out last year, it was sort of like the internet threw up your book on like all over the place. Like it was everywhere. Yeah, it was the cover was fantastic. It was Richard Anderson, who's, you know, like I'm his biggest fan. I think he's fantastic.
He's awesome.
Tor did, you know, chapter releases. They were giving the book away everywhere. Like it just got a big media blitz. I mean, you kind of had to feel like you won the publishing lottery.
You know, I felt and feel really lucky to be with Tor and with all the folks there. At the time, I had nothing to compare it to, though. I mean, it was my first book. I didn't know anyone else who was writing fantasy for a living, or really writing fantasy at all. And so this whole last year has just been sort of feeling my way. And every step of the game, you know, I sort of say to Hannah, my agent, or Marco, my editor, like, is this good? Is this bad? Did we do a good thing? And it was only sort of almost belatedly that I realized how well I'd been treated by Tor and how grateful I should have been all along. I mean, not that I wasn't grateful, but I just realized, wow, they really have done a lot for me, and I'm tremendously grateful for it.
I have to think, though, like, you had this marketing campaign, and you're, you know, this first-time author, and as you say, you weren't really in the community beforehand, and so all of a sudden, your book is everywhere. People are talking about it. People are asking you for stuff. The book comes out. People are criticizing you or complimenting you, but complimenting you is not as interesting. So we'll just go with, you know, like people are criticizing you for something. And like all of a sudden, like you're in the spotlight.
Yeah. Like, it was wild.
I specifically remember you and I having an exchange where it was like on Reddit or something. And I asked a tough question. And you responded to it well, but how prepared did you feel for that? Or was it just like all of a sudden you were like, oh, shit?
You know, I think that we knew what some of the main problems people were going to have with the book were going to be. I knew that Adair was going to be a problem. Marco knew that Adair was going to be a problem. We weren't shocked by that. I just hoped that she wouldn't be such a problem that nobody would ever buy book two. Because, I mean, you've read book two, you know she plays a much larger role. But that wasn't something that blindsided either me or Tor, I don't think. I was a little bit surprised by how vehemently some people felt it, but I guess that's part of the fun of the business, is that everybody takes something different away from a book and focuses on a different aspect of it. And so, you know, I read a lot of the early reviews. I read your review early on, and you know, I said to my wife, "Oh yeah, there's this guy named J. Diddy Esquire. He has some interesting thoughts about the book." And she said, "What the hell kind of name is that?" So I read a lot of the reviews in the first, like before it was released, and then in the first couple of weeks, and then I stopped reading them altogether, just because there's a point of diminishing returns. And I plan to do the same thing with Providence. I've read all the reviews so far, and I'll probably read them for the first couple of weeks. But then you don't need to read, you know, 500, 700 reviews of the book. You get the gist of what people like and what they don't like. You know, you can apply it if you think it's relevant or not, if not. So it was interesting.
Well, so I know that you were in the midst of writing that second book, essentially probably well before the first book actually came out, but you were still in draft mode when Emperor's Blades came out, I believe, or at least were still like definitely in edit mode. How much do you think those reviews that were coming in, I mean, did that influence anything that you actually did in the book, or were you able to just sort of be like, all right, that's nice, but I'm going to do my own thing?
You know, fortunately, you know, I thought there were two main veins of criticism of the Emperor's Blades. One was, what the fuck, why isn't there more Adair? And the other was, and fewer people felt this second thing. Some people said, well, there's a lot of training. And the first line of criticism I agreed with, I thought, oh yeah, it would be better if there was more Adair. So that wasn't a problem, that she was already all over the second book. And the second I didn't agree with, because I love training books and training movies, but the second book also wasn't a training book, because training's done by the second book. So that wasn't kind of a problem either. So I was lucky in that it seemed like the two main veins of criticism had already been addressed by the second book. And so I didn't feel like I ended up doing any edits directed at any of the reviews or criticism that I'd read from the first book. Those problems had, to the extent that they were problems, those problems had solved themselves, which was lucky.
I feel like if anybody's criticizing like a training montage storyline in an epic fantasy, like they probably have never read epic fantasy. Like, it is a quintessential trope.
Oh, I think it's a delightful one. I mean, I love it. That when I would read that, I would think, oh, that's interesting that people aren't into that. But, you know, I wouldn't change that. I mean, even about the first book, that was something I wanted to write. I set out to write that. So I thought, oh, they were just looking for a different book. And they're, you know, there's plenty of books out there without training.
It's funny. I distinctly remember in high school, you know, sitting around with some of my fellow nerds, and we were like, yeah, we should totally write a book. And we were like, yeah, we're going to write a fantasy book. You know what that book needs to have? Training montages. I mean, that was, it had to be there, you know?
If only there was a way just to get the soundtrack into the training montage, because that's what, you know, that would be the ultimate, is having, somehow you could send an iPod to every reader with your badass soundtrack for what they should be listening to while the characters are training.
You know, as you said all this, how have you gone through this first book, which by all accounts has been a big success? How do you judge your success as a debut author? Yeah, I think that's one of the most maddening parts about publishing for me, would be like, I wouldn't know when I was when I'd made it.
No, it's absolutely true. I mean, the numbers are so hard to come by, and when you do get them, you don't get them for another 6 months, and so it's really hard to say. But my goal when I started doing this is that I wanted to make a living doing it. And I'm doing that now, and it looks like I'll be able to continue doing that. So I put that as a big W in the win column. And everything above that is just gravy. So I feel pretty damn happy.
Yeah. As far as judging your success goes, I feel like being able to do it for a living is pretty high on the list. Now, you're an MFA holder for creative writing, and we have a few of those in the field. You know, there's Myrtle Lafferty and Zach Jernigan and a few others I know who have MFAs. I don't even think Jeff Vandermeer has one. And like, if anybody should have an MFA, it's Jeff Vandermeer. He may, I don't know. But
it certainly seems like he has one, just based on the book I read.
But I'm curious about like what you feel like the MFA added. I've heard a lot of people ask these questions about like, well, is an MFA worth it to me to do if I want to be a writer? And then I've heard a lot of people say like, only get the MFA if you want to teach writing. What do you think? I mean, did you think it was a big deal for your success as a writer?
Well, my, you know, what I studied in college and in grad school is poetry. I wrote just lots and lots of poetry. I didn't write fiction. So it was a really lateral move to come into writing fantasy from writing poetry for a bunch of years. And I'm just now working on a series of posts for Tor.com about what I learned writing poetry that's applicable to writing epic fantasy. And in thinking about that, I realized there's a lot that I learned. You know, it is so hard to gauge what, when you learned what and how you learned it. I really have no idea. What I tell people when they're asking whether they should get an MFA is if you can get a school to pay for you to do it, and you can swing it financially, then sure. It's a great time to work on your craft without distractions, and be around other writers. But getting a school to pay for your MFA is hard. And even if they are paying for it, swinging it financially is hard. And it's just not plausible for shitloads of people. And I certainly don't think it's necessary. I think far more valuable than all of my schooling and, you know, all credit to my teachers and instructors who were wonderful and taught me a lot. I think the most important thing is just reading all the time. That I think I learned everything I needed to know to write fantasy from just reading a lot. But I love my time writing poetry, and I still write poetry a little bit, and, you know, maybe someday I'll write some more of it. Well, I'm not on deadline for this series.
Oh, he wrote poetry. I think what they would expect you to write in prose is something snooty, probably, because that's what
right.
That's the connotation we have of poetry, even if it's not always the case. You know, sure. Especially structurally, yeah. You know, you play with structural yeah. poetry and how narrative works and all that kind of stuff. Interestingly, I think Saladin Ahmed is a poet first as well. Who came into mm-hmm. fiction, which is interesting. But talk a little bit about that transition. I mean, I don't think anybody would say a poet is going to come and write epic fantasy that's a hell of a lot more about the story than it is about the words.
You know, the bedrock of all of the reading I was doing as a kid was reading fantasy. I hated poetry until sort of college, the beginning of college. I didn't read any of it. So all of that poetry is sediment laid down on a bedrock of epic fantasy and caring about stories and characters and plots. But I will say the big thing that's been handy about all the poetry study is that I feel like the language is... I have plenty of struggles when writing books. I have struggles with plots. I have struggles with characters and dialogue and voice. But the language and rhythm, I think, is there whenever I reach for it. So it's one element among many that I don't feel like I need to worry about. If I'm looking for a certain cadence, I have it. And that's really handy, especially considering I'm struggling really hard with all these other fucking things. So I think that's been the biggest thing. I feel like, you know, when I want to shift idiom or take it up a notch, make it more formal, less formal, all those sorts of things, that feels very natural. And so I can play with a lot of the other questions, like you were saying, about character and plot and moving the whole thing forward, not getting bogged down, which I don't have as much experience with. And so that was the challenge that I wanted to take on when I started writing epic fantasy. I wanted to write a beach read. I wanted to write a page turner. I didn't want to write a work of literature. And I thought, well, I'll gauge my success at this enterprise by, you know, basically how many people stay up past their bedtime to read it, which nobody does with poetry, by the way. Nobody stays up past their bedtime to read poetry, myself included.
Yeah, no, I can't say that I do, although I did, to your great credit, I stayed up till 2 in the morning reading Providence of Fire. So
I'm thrilled. There we go. That makes me happy. It puts a smile on my face.
So you mentioned reading earlier and how important reading is to sort of developing what you need to know to write. And this is one of the classic problems of being a published writer, is that what I find with most of the people that I talk to is they find themselves with very little time to read.
Yep.
How are you doing in that?
Not great. Maybe not as bad as others. I was trying to figure out how many books I read this past year, and my guess is it was around 20, which is paltry by the standards that I had when I was in eighth grade and reading books beneath the desk of my math class. But it feels all right to me. You know, I'd say I read a couple books a month, and most of them I would say, in a way, the biggest thing that I feel about reading, which is a weird thing to feel, is that I wish I was reading less fantasy and science fiction. Not because I'm not enjoying what I'm reading. I really am. But I used to read a much broader range of stuff. I would read a lot of nonfiction and a lot of philosophy and religion. And now I just feel like to keep up with the field and with what's out there and people I'm going to meet, that I'm always thinking, oh yeah, I need to read this book, or she just wrote that book and I really want to read that. And so I'm almost exclusively reading science fiction and fantasy. I never thought I'd come to the point where I thought, oh, I wish I was reading less of this, but I do a little bit. I'd like to have more time to read. I've got this biography of Caesar sitting on my shelf staring at me, and I keep looking at it and think, I just can't read that. It's 600 pages long, and I'm sure it's wonderful, but there's just no time. So I'm getting through the fantasy and sci-fi mostly that I want to, but everything else has fallen by the wayside.
That's interesting. Yeah, one of the curses of being a science fiction and fantasy blogger is, like, even when you get sent, like, biographies and memoirs, they're, like, about a science fiction author. You know, it's like...
Right, yeah.
No offense, Tor, but, like, I really don't want to read Harry Harrison's biography. Like, it's just not high on my list of things to do.
That's going to go over here.
Yeah, that one's going to make its way to another home, I'm sure. Of course, I imagine the blurb requests are starting to come in.
They are, yeah. I mean, I'm pretty good at saying preemptively, I don't have time to do more of these now. And so I tackle the ones that I can and the ones that I'm excited about. And, you know, again, you can't do it all.
What's the first book you blurbed?
The first book I blurbed, let's see, I blurbed The Mirror Empire for Cameron Hurley. I've blurbed Max Gladstone's books. I just blurbed a new book for Ilana Meyer that's coming out from Tor. It's not out. It'll be her debut. So I've only done maybe a couple more. They're escaping me right now. I've only done maybe half a dozen. And I just, you know, these books are long. Shit. I mean, they're long books. And it's not that I don't want to read them. And I'm acutely aware of how grateful I was to have my own book blurbed. You know, I was nobody knew me. The people who blurbed my book universally were people who had no idea who I was. And so I do want to do it. And it's something that I think is important for debut authors especially. And so I do try to keep doing it, but I can't handle necessarily all the volume that could be there.
You talked a little bit about how when you sent your book out for blurb, like, nobody knew you. And now that this book's been out for a year, you've got your second book coming out, like, you are now on Twitter, you're now part of the community.
Yeah.
A community of which you probably weren't even aware of a year ago, that it even existed, other than peripherally.
Yeah, that's right. Only very vaguely.
Right. I mean, what's that kind of been like? I mean, there's all these discussions going on. You wrote a book in a vacuum inside your own mind, and now you find it sort of being judged in this community of which you had no knowledge of. Like, how could you know these things were being discussed or were at issue?
Right. I think it's exciting. You know, it's invigorating just to see people caring, A, about fantasy and sci-fi in general, and B, about my books in particular. And, you know, it's exciting that so many people have enjoyed the book, but also the people who haven't, they have some strong feelings. And I think it's kind of cool just to see, like, kind of the drama playing out online about, like, you know, who's looking for what in a novel. And, you know, it's helped me to think about my writing and what I want to do with it. I sort of wrote the first book in a vacuum. You know, I moved to Asia and I just thought, well, Game of Thrones was about 300,000 words and Eye of the World was about 300,000 words. So I guess I should write a book that's about 300,000 words. And that was about all the thought that went into it. Until I came back and realized, oh, shit, I wrote a book that's way too long and nobody wants it. And so that gives you a sense of how clueless I was about, you know, all the discussions of the myriad facets of sci-fi and fantasy. And so it's just neat to be part of the conversation, both having my book be part of the conversation and for me myself to kind of take part in it. Even though I don't, like, I'm still, I think, a pretty peripheral presence. Partly just because I don't really have the time to go to a lot of conventions and do a lot of the stuff where it seems like a lot of the drama for good and for ill plays out.
I want to circle back a little bit to something you said earlier. You talked about how poetry has helped you voice and moving in and out of different voices and taking it up a notch or dropping it down a notch. And it's interesting that you have these, you know, basically three characters around which your books are built. Adair, yeah. Valen, and Caden. You know, Caden, for example, is you're writing this character who most of the time has no emotion because he's...
Yeah, that's nightmarish for an author.
Yeah, I bet it is. And then you've got Valen, who is temperamental and supposedly awesome, and yet he fucks up a lot. And then you've got Adair, who has all of these really great qualities, but she's sort of like frozen out over and over again. And you've presented yourself some like real challenges with these characters, and you know, shifting in and out. It had to be a challenge to write such disparate characters. I mean, none of these—they all sort of fit a fantasy stereotype, but not really. I mean, you've kind of twisted them a little bit and made them unique in that way. Yeah.
Well, I don't know when I made this distinction. Sometime early on, I kind of thought, and it's a gross oversimplification, but it was useful to me in a lot of ways to think about the three siblings as each having mastery in a certain realm. So I thought Adair is the smart one, Valen's the strong one, and Caden is sort of the emotionally controlled one, right? Caden has emotional control, Valen has physical control, and Adair has intellectual capacity. And you know, I think that it's not that, you know, Caden's stupid or Adair's weak. That's why I say it's an oversimplification. But whenever I would get sort of stuck and feel like, these plot lines are running too parallel, or these characters are seeming too much like each other, I would sort of go back to that really oversimplified version and think, okay, well, what are the challenges going to be for Adair? What are they going to be for Valen? You know, there's a piece of criticism about Hamlet and Othello. I don't know where it's from, but I always thought it was just a really nice insight that if you swap the main characters, if you put Othello in Hamlet and you put Hamlet in Othello, there'd be no play, because Othello would just instantly go kill Claudius in scene one, and that would be the end of that play. And Hamlet would never be kind of goaded along by Iago in the same way that Othello is. You know, the plays result from the characters' limitations, right? Not really from their strengths. They're put in situations where they can't really utilize their strengths to full advantage. And I wanted to do that with my characters. So Adair is really smart. I think she's by far the smartest of the three siblings, but she's not really in a position where she can use her smarts because, as you said, she's sort of frozen out of the structure of government by and large. You know, you have to kind of torture these poor kids a little bit. And that was the goal.
You wrote this novel to begin with. You had three basic points of view. Jog my memory in the first book. Did you have any other POVs in the first book? Or was it just the three?
No, not aside from in the prologue. But right. Aside from that, no.
Now, yep. In the second book, you've added some POV. Why?
Well, you know, originally, to be totally honest, it was a technical problem. I just needed a point of view character where some stuff was happening and none of the siblings were there. It started out as a technical problem, which I think is cool. I think a lot of the things I'm most excited about my books started as just technical problems. I need to get this person from here to there. I need to manage this in this time frame. And so I added, I don't know how much of a spoiler this will be for the readers. I guess not huge. I added Gwenna as a point of view character. And, you know, I've finished a draft of book three now. So I can see the whole scope of the trilogy. And, I think it would be a really different series without Gwenna as a point of view character in book two. And, in a way, she's great because she plays off the Malkinians. Those three Malkinian siblings are so busted by the end of book two, all in their separate ways, that Gwenna, I think, kind of emerges as a foil for all three of them. And so I'm really glad to have her in there beyond the fact that just somebody needs to be in this one place at this one time to narrate some stuff. I think she does a lot more than just that simple load bearing. And so I'm excited to have her in the books.
When you wrote her in as a POV character, you're almost making a contract with the reader that this side character is now going to be more important than you thought she was.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you said it right. You are almost making a contract with the reader that she will be more important in book three. And now you can decide whether almost or contract is more important there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the, and this leads into a huge can of worms that I'm always fascinated by, and that is the contract that you make with your reader and how you deliver on that promise without being transparent. There's a device, and you use it a little bit in the second book, and I don't recall if it's in the first book. I don't think it is, but you see it from time to time. It's really challenging when you have these multiple POV characters who are interacting with each other. And that's when one of the characters knows something that the other character does not. And one of them acts on that information with the other one. And as the reader, you're like, don't do that.
Well, yeah, I wonder how many more years we're going to be able to write stories like that, because we are so accustomed to having cell phones and Skype and computers that the idea of two characters misunderstanding each other because they were just in different places and couldn't talk seems, I think it can seem gimmicky. It's like, oh, they should just talk to each other. But I think a lot about, you know, Napoleon kind of blundering around in Russia with a whole army, unable to come to grips with another whole army, right? You know, that was the condition of the pre-technological world, is nobody knew shit about anything, right? You could have major developments happening in one city, and another city 200 miles away wouldn't hear about it for at least a day or 2 days, let alone the kind of clandestine maneuverings that are taking place, you know, in my book or in a lot of books like this. So I do think that it's an organic byproduct of the world, just that the characters have to be ignorant. The place that I'm wary about it when I'm writing is when the characters actually come together. They do withhold some information from each other. I want there to be valid psychological reasons for that withholding, not just plot-based reasons. And I think, I feel pleased, and readers will have to decide if they are or not, I feel pleased with the way the characters sort of comport themselves in the second book. I think whenever they hold something back from the other character, they have a really good reason, given what they know about that other character and about the context of the world they're in, not to share that information. And I've been over those passages with a fine-tooth comb, because I've read a lot of books where you think, this is bullshit. There's no reason Jimmy wouldn't tell Charlize that the bomb's in his suitcase, right? They're best friends, and what, he just didn't get around to telling her? And that drives me crazy. So I'm willing to frustrate the readers. I hope that they will agree that the frustration seems inevitable, given the situations of the characters. But, you know, I don't know. Did you think it seemed contrived and gimmicky? Or did you think, yeah, fuck, it's irritating as hell, but really, she had to do that, or he had to do that?
I think your observation about technology is really insightful, because I think you're right. I think we have an expectation. And, of course, like, we're also in an era where just talking about your feelings is, like, more normal. Right. You know, like, we're just, I'm upset. Let's just talk about it. You know, let's just time out, guys. Let's have a hash out. Let's hug it out, you know? And that isn't always real. It isn't always how people actually interact. And I do think there's valid reasons why your characters do what they do. Even if you can recognize and appreciate that, it doesn't necessarily alleviate the frustration that you're like, could you just fix it? You know, because the outcome is bad.
Right.
You know,
right.
For these characters that you've spent a whole book loving, right? And I think it's a natural challenge. It's like when, you know, when George R. R. Martin kills off Robb Stark, you know, mm-hmm. you're like,
yeah,
that didn't have to happen.
right. Yeah. I mean, I like frustration in books that I read, but I think there are two types of frustration. There's the frustration where you feel like you are being led around by the nose, just because the author wants to bring you somewhere. And I don't really enjoy that. And then there's the frustration where you think, God damn it, I wish this could work out differently for these characters, and it can't. You know, the frustration, we mentioned Hamlet earlier, just the frustration you feel with Hamlet for being fucking Hamlet. You know, it's be any other character, and all this could be avoided. But, you know, it wouldn't be Hamlet then. Not that I'm writing Hamlet over here, but just that... I think some of those frustrations, the good frustrations, emerge organically from the faults of character.
speaking of Shakespeare, though, it does really feel like you're setting up all three of your primary characters. I mean, they are all tragic. They're all tragedies. I mean, they really, yeah, at least thus, yeah, far. I certainly don't think you're writing in any way, shape, or form what I would classify as grimdark. But we do, mm-hmm, have a predisposition in fantasy these days for things not to go well.
Right.
Almost, right, almost as an excuse for realism, right? Like, well, in the real world, shit's bad. So we're going to...
You're right.
You know, and in the 80s, of course, all the fantasy was like, it's all going to turn out, yeah, fine. You read a lot of this in the 80s. I mean, do you think that some of this is informed by that?
Yeah, it's so hard to trace influences, and you know, you get these questions in interviews sometimes, like, what books really influenced you? Which is another one of those questions, which is just a chance to look like an asshole. Because if you're like, oh, well, I was very influenced by Tolkien, and, you know, Kafka and Faulkner had a big effect on my syntax, and Shakespeare mostly on my characterization. But so I don't really know what my influences are, but I do think that I've thought a lot about that shit's bad versus shit's good dichotomy. And the place that I've settled down, both about life and about books, are that shit's messy. And so I wanted to write a messy book. not necessarily a book where everybody gets killed or has horrible things happen to them, but where, you know, there's some good, there's some bad, and there's some ugly. And so, you know, Joe Abercrombie is obviously the guy who's heralded as, I mean, he's Lord Grimdark on Twitter. But my favorite book of his is The Heroes, because I think in that book, you know, some stuff is bad and some characters are good all the way through, and some shit you're just like, I don't even really know what that meant. That was just kind of messy in a weird way. And that's satisfying to me. And so that's the kind of book that I'm trying to produce. You know, I want there to be moments of humor and joy in the book. I want there to be moments of real camaraderie for the characters. But I also want there to be moments of struggle and despair. And those are interesting things to try and balance.
The first book, as many first books are, was a more tight story in that three characters each undergoing their own sort of mini crucible to become, mm-hmm, adults. And although there's a big overarching storyline that leads into the second book, you know, they each complete sort of like their coming of age.
Right, in the first book.
Right, even Adair, who has, yeah, a relatively, yeah, small part, is able to complete, yeah, that cycle. In the second book, yeah, the sprawl begins, right? Like the epic fantasy sprawl begins. The conflict, yeah, yeah, becomes clear. You add in a lot of additional bits of where your story is really coming from that weren't really remotely apparent in the first book. I guess this is what makes fantasy epic. But it's also kind of a trap, right? We're sort of like, oh my God, this is getting so big. How do I manage this? How do I keep it narrow? And it's interesting you brought up Abercrombie, and there's certainly other writers who have told these big epic fantasy stories but kept them really small. You, yeah, were definitely heading toward the big stuff.
Yes.
Are you leery of that?
Well, I'll tell you, I was really fucking leery when I was writing the third book and trying to pull all that sprawl back together. you know, I don't know if you've heard this, I initially pitched 7 books to Marco over at Tor, and he very politely and kindly told me that there's no way that we were going to do that. He's like, I don't even know if you can write 3 books. Right. And I'm so glad. I'm so glad. Marco, if you're listening to this, thank you. Thank you for saving me. Because 3 books proved a really, really daunting challenge for me. It was a challenge, I think, that was just right for my level of experience and stupidity. And so, yeah, the thing is, it's always easier to blow things open and to create more sprawl and more characters and more places and more battles and more armies. That's the beguiling thing about book 2. You think, I'll do it all. And then you get to book 3 and you think, this is trouble. I've got, you know, I made a list when I started book 3, and I had something like 25 characters that I thought readers are going to expect real and meaningful character arcs and conclusions for all 25 of these characters. And that was just a daunting place to begin a book. Because when I started book 1, I had, you know, a handful of characters. Fortunately, I feel good about where book 3 is now, and I've got a little bit of time to make some of the edits that I want to make. But yeah, I think you can get out of hand real fast. I had a friend, I was lamenting this over beers one night with a friend, and he was like, look, just have Anik start killing people. You know, just like these 18 people, Anik can just kill them in one scene. But of course, that's not satisfying for the reader. But it was sorely tempting. But, you know, on the other hand, we're drawn, both as writers and readers, you're drawn to these sprawling stories for a reason, which is that most of our lives don't tend to be sprawling. You know, I live here in Vermont, and I bring wood up from the basement, and I go sledding, and I work on my book, and go down, you know, the road to play poker with my buddies in the old defunct bus. And it's not, it's hardly epic. Nothing about it is epic. And so I wanted to write a book that you know, was took place on two continents and had, you know, multiple factions and ancient races and stuff. I'm not sure I fully appreciated how difficult it would be to stick the landing with something like that, but I also wanted a good challenge, so that was definitely a good challenge.
Another author who read your book and I were talking, and we were discussing your book, and we had this whole, we were like, yeah, you know, I love this book. Yeah, I loved it too. And then, of course, for the next 30 minutes, we were like, yeah, but I didn't like this part. Yeah, but I like this part. But this part kind of bugged me. We'd gotten in, and we were like, Jesus, we're nitpicking. This is just a good book. And it gets down to the point where, and I've talked to this, I'm going to talk about this a little bit in a future podcast with Mike Cole, which I've already recorded. The internets are confused. We just talked about, like, writers having the juice. And that's sort of a silly term, because it's often associated with like steroids or something, but it's like when you read a paragraph or a chapter or a short story or a novel, you can sense when like a writer just sort of like has the ability to tell a story. And even if the prose sucks, not saying this is your book by any means, but you know, you say like, you know, people often accuse Brandon Sanderson of not writing you know, very good prose, that it's, you know, workmanlike or whatever. But like nobody can deny, like the man just tells great stories. Or you have, like, Elizabeth Baer, who can be kind of overly baroque at times, but is, again, like, just tells a great story. And you read the books and you can't stop reading because they're just, they're so good, even though you can see all the flaws that your brain is picking up, your other part of your brain that just wants to get sucked into a story just goes away. Do you see this in other writers? And, like, how do you quantify it? Like,
I definitely see it in other writers. Quantifying it is really hard. For me now, one of the main things when I'm reading someone else's book is if I stop thinking about all the technical things that went into it, like how are they handling point of view? How are they moving characters around? How do they get that reveal to fit in here? You know, like I'm always thinking, I think every writer is thinking about stuff like that. But when you read a really good book, you just stop thinking about that and you're like, get on the spaceship. No, not that spaceship. Don't blow that up. Those guys are good. And you stop thinking about all of the craft stuff. And when that happens to me, I know I'm in the hands of somebody who's doing his or her job really well. With my own books, it's sometimes hard to gauge whether what I've written is any good. And fortunately, I have a brilliant wife who will just tell me this chapter was a pile of shit. Why did you write it? So that's handy. But also, I find when I read through even like a completed draft, there are certain chapters that I find myself getting really excited about. And, you know, I can feel sort of a little bit of a tingling. And there are certain chapters that just fall flat. And I can justify the flat chapters in any number of ways. I need it for this or I need it for that, or no, it does this, or it'll be cooler for that reason. But really, in the end, yeah, I just have to cut them. If I go back to a chapter, not necessarily right away, sometimes you're just sick of it, but if I go back to it a week later and I don't get excited to read it, it's got to go. So it's like, I guess an answer to two different questions. One, how do I kind of quantify what's working and what's not working in my own writing? And two, what am I looking for in other stuff?
I'm always trying to put my finger on this emotion that I get with books and like, well, why is it working for me? And it's one of those things that I read authors that I know I shouldn't like. You know, it's like I read them and I'm like, oh my God, there's so many problems in this, but I just get swept away.
You know, since I started writing these, I've tried really, just as you said, to really think about that exact question. And I think about it when I'm in bed at night and I've finished a chapter and it's late and I know that my son's going to be up at 5:30 and I'm like, do I read another chapter or not? And if I do, what is it that propels me into the next chapter? And it's a surprisingly hard question to answer, but I think that for me, there are a few, it's not just, you know, you described it as the juice, but for me, there might be a different sort of flavors of juice, because one thing that will definitely keep me reading even in books that I loathe, is a mystery. Just like any kind of mystery. Who is that woman over there in the black cloak? You know, anything that's mysterious to the characters and presented as a mystery, I need to know the answer to it. And so I've been propelled through countless books that I would not have otherwise read just to find out the answer. But another thing that will keep me reading is if there's just a character or a character pairing that I like, especially in the dialogue. I mentioned that I really loved Abercrombie's book, The Heroes. I did not like his book, Best Served Cold. I didn't think it was very good, and it was super dark. But Nkomo Koska, the mercenary captain, was such a delightful character, just to me, that anytime I saw him on the page, I would just read, you know, that whole chapter. And if there was another chapter with him, I'd read that chapter. Wool, by the way, was an example of that Hugh Howey book. That was an example of a book that I read just to solve the mystery. You know, what happens when they go out of the silo? And once I figured that out, I was like, okay, I'm good. That's, you know, the rest of it was fine. I finished it. But so I think that maybe it might even be too simplistic. You know, we both might, you know, stay up late reading one book for one reason and another book for an entirely different reason. And then, of course, the great books are the ones that do all that stuff.
I think that's a good observation that that mysteries work that way. Yeah. No, I think you're right. Just for fun, the other day I got two John Grisham books on Audible. Premise of the book, one of them was called The Judge. Mm-hmm. And the premise of the book was this old judge dies, and his son goes to his house to clean up, you know, to find out what's in the house that they've inherited. And he opens up the dresser, and he finds $1 million in cash. And the question is, where did this upstanding judge get $1 million from?
I'm going to have to read
this book. And the whole premise of the book is just figuring out where the money came from. You find out about, I don't know, 75% of the way through the book. You're right. Like, once I knew where the money came from, I was like, could this thing be over any sooner?
Yeah. You know? Exactly. Right.
And once I figured it out, it was just, it was like, that was it. That's all I needed to know. Maybe you've partially solved my crisis.
In terms of a really reliable one, that gets me every time. And it doesn't even need to be, as you said, it doesn't even need to be a sophisticated mystery. Just, where did this $1 million come from? I want to know.
Right, and I think in Providence of Fire, a great example is that as you finally show us a Sestrium character. And that reveal, and waiting for that guy to come back on screen each time to get those details. You know, also the mystery of Triste and who she is and all of that background. I mean, those are good examples of mysteries that are really making the reader want to get to those Caden chapters.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think another thing that especially for fantasy readers that they want to see, fantasy readers, myself very much included, want to see the badasses be super badass. And so, you know, there's always this thing like Aragorn, like kind of wandering around as Strider for a long time. And I think specifically of Jim Butcher's Codex Alera series where, this is a spoiler for the first couple of books, but there's some awesome, like the best swordsman in the kingdom is just disguised as a servant or something. And you know, if you've read 10 fantasy novels, you know from the second chapter that this guy is not really a servant, that he's awesome and he's the best swordsman in the kingdom. But you want to see him kick ass. And I read, you know, that whole book. And then at the end of the first book, he reveals himself. He is who you thought he was. He kicks ass. It's awesome. And then Jim Butcher did this really bold thing in the second book. Everybody, or not everybody, but some crucial characters saw the scene take place. They saw the sword fight. Then the second book, the guy's like, no, I'm not that guy. I'm still undercover. And they're like, dude, we saw you at the end of the first book kill all those guys. We know who you are. And he goes through the whole second book undercover again, even though the reader knows who he is, and the characters who know who he is. And at the end of the second book, he kills a whole bunch of other people in an awesome battle. And it's just as awesome. It's like none less awesome. And so that's another thing that has dragged me through many fantasy novels, is just waiting to see the awesome people be awesome. And it was I have to say, this is not really a spoiler, but it was a real satisfaction of writing the third book in a fantasy trilogy. That's when the awesome people get to be awesome.
Providence of Fire comes out tomorrow, or a day after this goes live, because this will go up on Wednesday. So congratulations.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. It was a lot of fun.
Absolutely, man. It's a blast. I can't wait to read book 3. This has been Rocket Talk.